Hello, and welcome to Conversations from the World of Allergy, a podcast produced by the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. I'm your host, Dave Stukas. I'm a board-certified allergist and immunologist and serve as a social media medical editor for the Academy. Our podcast series will use different formats to interview thought leaders from the world of allergy and immunology. This podcast is not intended to provide any individual medical advice to our listeners. We do hope that our conversations provide evidence-based information. Any questions pertaining to one's own health should always be discussed with their personal physician. The Find an Allergist search engine on the Academy website is a useful tool to locate a listing of board-certified allergists in your area. Finally, use of this audio program is subject to the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Terms of Use Agreement, which you can find at www.aaaai.org. Today's edition of our Conversations from the World of Allergy podcast series is from our Hot Topic series, and we'll focus on an update regarding COVID-19 vaccines. We are pleased to welcome back Dr. John Kelso as a return guest for this topic. Dr. Kelso joined the podcast soon after COVID vaccines were originally released for public use in December 2020 and returns today to provide an update almost 1 year later. Dr. Kelso is a practicing allergist within the Division of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology at Scripps Clinic in San Diego and a clinical professor of pediatrics and internal medicine at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. He has a special interest in adverse reactions to vaccines and served as the chief editor for the 2012 Adverse Reactions to Vaccines Practice Parameter Update. This is an important time to emphasize to our listeners that the information we discuss today is current as of November 15th, 2021. Throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, we have learned that information and evidence evolves over time. As such, the information we discuss during today's episode may be subject to change, and I encourage everyone to stay up to date through vetted resources such as the Academy's COVID-19 Task Force updates or the Centers for Disease Control. And with that, Dr. Kelso, welcome back to the show, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me back.
No, I think this is great. And our last conversation received such wonderful feedback, and you are just a wealth of information. So we just had to have you back now that we have so much more to talk about. And last time we chatted in December of 2020, the vaccines were just being rolled out. And since then, there now have been over 430 million doses administered, and almost 200 million Americans have been fully vaccinated, with over 3 billion people worldwide having been fully vaccinated as well. Here we are 11 months later after our initial conversation. What are your overall thoughts on how the vaccine campaign is going?
Well, I guess I would say generally well, but with a few significant shortcomings. We continue to struggle to get everyone vaccinated due to vaccine hesitancy in the U.S. and other developed countries where there's a plentiful supply of vaccine, and also due to the ongoing unavailability of the vaccine in many low and middle-income countries.
Yeah. Did you think that maybe we would have had even more people vaccinated by this point, or you know, any thoughts on, you know, if this pandemic perhaps could have, you know, been on the way out, per se, if we could have gotten more vaccines and more arms by now?
Oh, certainly. So had we been able to vaccinate more people in countries where vaccine was and is available sooner, and also been able to roll out more vaccine around the world, we certainly couldn't have gotten ahead of this and had a much greater impact in terms of limiting deaths from this disease.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Well, what have we learned thus far regarding the efficacy of COVID vaccines in both adults and adolescents?
Well, importantly, just as in the clinical trials, the vaccines have proved to be remarkably effective, virtually eliminating the risk of hospitalization or death in fully vaccinated people. Hundreds of thousands of lives have been saved in the U.S. and literally millions around the world with the vaccines.
And if I recall correctly, this was early autumn of last year. So before the vaccine data was even publicly available, I believe the FDA came out and said if they could see, you know, 50% efficacy for the vaccines, that they would consider that to be, you know, tremendous benefit. Did these vaccines surpass that?
Oh, absolutely. So you're correct that was the benchmark for a vaccine to have some impact on the pandemic if it could at least be 50% effective. And the vaccine efficacy has turned out both in the trials and in real life to be well above 90%, 95%, And that has made a huge difference. So the vaccines really have been a home run.
Yeah, a home run, absolutely. We also know that there's been intense scrutiny of these vaccines throughout both the development and then through deployment and with, you know, hundreds of millions of people receiving these vaccines. So what type of monitoring system has been in place in the United States?
Well, really very careful monitoring. So in addition to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS, which is the passive reporting system that's used for all vaccines, the CDC has also rolled out something called VSafe, which is a smartphone app that sends text messages to vaccine recipients who have enrolled in the program to actively inquire about any sort of adverse events following immunization. And also, several large healthcare organizations have published studies describing careful monitoring of vaccine recipients, usually the healthcare workers within their organizations. And all of that has provided essentially real-time information on adverse reactions to vaccines. Again, not only those passively reported, but seeking out, actively inquiring about adverse reactions. And all of that information really has been generally very reassuring.
And as more and more people get these vaccines, and with that intense scrutiny and monitoring, that should allow for very rare events to sort of be caught. Is that correct?
Well, correct. Because even in studies of the vaccines where there may be tens of thousands of participants in the vaccine trial, if an event occurs in 1 in 100,000 or 1 in 1,000,000 people, you're likely not going to pick it up in the vaccine trial. But these follow-on monitoring systems would allow some assessment of those very rare adverse events.
And speaking of, I know that is one of the main points of concern, and you already talked about vaccine hesitancy. So can you offer some insight regarding more of the main adverse events that have been reported? And along those lines, let's start with concerns about blood clots associated with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. What have we learned from that?
So there is a condition called VITT, for vaccine-induced thrombotic thrombocytopenia, which involves thrombus formation, sometimes in unusual locations, such as the cerebral venous sinus or splanchnic vein, and low platelet counts that occurs 5 to 30 days after receiving the J&J vaccine. It has been reported not only after that vaccine, which is the one administered in the U.S. of that platform, but also the AstraZeneca COVID vaccine, which is used outside the U.S., but both of those vaccines are adenoviral vector DNA vaccines. It appears that this condition is associated with or brought on by autoantibodies against a particular platelet factor, although it's not clear how the vaccine would cause this production of these autoantibodies or lead to this rare side effect. The patients who have been most effective have been younger women, but that may simply reflect the demographics of the initial wave of vaccine recipients being mostly healthcare workers, and that group skewing toward younger women. It really is rare. So this is a good example of one of those things that they wouldn't have seen in the vaccine trials, because the estimated rate of this is about 2 per million vaccinations. So this really is a very rare, potentially serious, but very rare side effect of these particular vaccines. But it's also a good example of weighing the risk of vaccination against no vaccination, because thrombotic complications from COVID disease itself occur at a much higher rate than these rare complications with the vaccines. So it's recommended that patients who have happened to develop this VITT after the J&J vaccine not receive additional doses of the J&J vaccine, but they can, in fact, receive booster doses with one of the mRNA vaccines.
Okay. What about this concern surrounding myocarditis? Can you explain what that is, and in particular, how vaccine-induced myocarditis may differ from episodes caused by actual infection?
Sure. So myocarditis, or in some cases pericarditis, that's another rare complication related to COVID vaccination, but in this case with the mRNA vaccines from Pfizer or Moderna. This does seem to be more consistently age and sex related, being seen almost all in adolescent and young adult males. So males, say, between 12 and 29 years of age. And in that demographic, in that group, the rate is maybe 40 per million doses. So more common than the previous adverse event we discussed, but still quite rare. And that 40 per million, again, is honed in on that particular age and sex group. These patients have typically presented with chest pain, palpitations, or shortness of breath within a week of vaccination, usually after their second dose. Most of the cases have been mild and the symptoms have resolved fairly quickly. For now, it's recommended that patients who have had myocarditis after an mRNA COVID vaccine not receive additional doses of any COVID vaccine, at least for the time being. However, importantly, patients who have had a history of myocarditis unrelated to COVID vaccination can receive any COVID vaccine. And here again, you know, we're sort of, as you kind of alluded to, the kind of natural disease, just the rate of that, the COVID disease itself can very definitely cause myocarditis or pericarditis, in some cases with long-term sequelae and at a higher rate than that associated with the vaccine.
In fact, if I recall correctly, I think, you know, major college football conferences delayed the start of their season due to these concerns. Was it in regards to myocarditis with athletes? Does that ring a bell with you?
I think I do remember something along those lines. And that, you know, as you suggested at the outset, we really have learned a lot in this year since these vaccines rolled out. So we have a lot more information now about the rate of these rare side effects and which groups might be more prone to them. But we've also had the information about seeing, unfortunately, people with the disease and the consequences that they suffer, which allows us to have a risk benefit analysis. And in virtually all cases, that comes down on the side of vaccination being more likely to prevent the very conditions that patients might be concerned about as a side effect of the vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love how you're explaining things in terms of overall risk as well as risk from the vaccine compared to risk from actual infection. And it also these important differences between the type of vaccine as well as the patient groups and things like that. So how do you discuss these difficult concepts with patients? That seems like a lot of ground to cover when people have questions surrounding it.
Well, it really is, and it takes some time, but I think it's important time spent. That aspect is really an important part of the discussion, these rare adverse events with vaccination. And what we're doing or trying to do for the patient is put them into context. The patient often thinks they're weighing the risk of getting the vaccine against no risk. So they think, well, if I don't get the vaccine, I'm not putting myself or my child at risk for these rare adverse events. But really, that's not the correct calculation. What they're weighing is the risk of these rare adverse events against the risk of not being vaccinated, of remaining susceptible to the disease, which dramatically increases the risk of getting COVID and symptomatic COVID, which itself has a much higher rate of some of the very same adverse events. And of course, in addition to the huge array of other consequences of having COVID, cardiac, respiratory, neurological, and otherwise, and the risk of death from COVID, which is substantial. And then now, as we're seeing with more and more people, this so-called long COVID disease, where people have sequelae months and after the infection. So patients and sometimes even providers may perceive that withholding the vaccine for fear of an adverse event is somehow prudent or conservative, when in fact, remaining unvaccinated carries a very high risk.
Mm-hmm. And what if somebody were to, you know, they have this conversation with you, but then they say, well, I don't know anybody who had COVID, or, you know, I know somebody who got one of these vaccines and then they, you know, passed out 3 days later or something like that. So how do you help people understand those sort of anecdotal experiences that they may or may not have?
Well, I think, again, kind of putting it in context, the figures I've been using lately are to remind people that maybe they don't know anybody, but the disease is still out there. We get a a bulletin once a week that tells us how many patients within our Scripps Hospital system here in San Diego are hospitalized with the disease, how many are in the ICU, and then the number I keep track of is how many patients we have in our very own hospitals on ventilators right now because of COVID, and it's 19 people. So today there's 19 people in our hospitals on a ventilator because of this disease. And also to remind people that we're still, there's about 1,000 people across the country dying from this disease every day. So I think those are kind of facts and figures that somehow may jog people's consciousness in a way that to let them realize that the disease is out there and that it's potentially deadly.
Mm-hmm. No, and as you stated, it takes a lot of time, and we have to make ourselves available to listen to these concerns and have conversations and meet people where they are at that point in time. Well, you know, shortly before we last spoke, there were the initial reports of anaphylaxis to the COVID vaccines. I believe that was out of the United Kingdom initially. So what have we learned in regards to the rate of anaphylaxis to these vaccines?
So the reported rate of anaphylaxis, particularly with the mRNA COVID vaccines, where it's been reported more commonly, the numbers have fluctuated, but the latest numbers are somewhere in the vicinity of 2 to 5 per million doses of the mRNA vaccines, and much less frequently with the J&J vaccine. And that our comparator for that is that we kind of think that with all vaccines in general, there's a rate of anaphylaxis about 1 per million doses. So if this really is 2 to 5 per million, it's somewhat elevated over a background rate, if you will, or a rate that you would expect or tolerate with other vaccines, but still a very rare event.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like that's actually even declined somewhat since the beginning. Is that correct? After hundreds of millions of doses.
That's correct. Some of the initial estimates were 10 per million or 20 per million, and then they've kind of, as time has gone on, those numbers have come down.
Well, Dr. Kelso, have you figured it out, or like-minded colleagues that have investigated this? Is there a specific mechanism that's causing anaphylaxis in those rare reports?
Well, we really are still trying to figure that out. Although some of the immediate reactions after vaccination do, in fact, seem to be anaphylactic, we really wouldn't have anticipated that because, of course, IgE-mediated reactions require some prior exposure for sensitization, and almost all allergens are proteins. So that really doesn't fit. So the fact that nobody's ever had this vaccine before, so you don't have prior exposure to generate IgE antibody, and there's no protein in the vaccine. So that, particularly the first doses, at least in theory, it wouldn't be possible to be allergic to the vaccine. So it really is not something that we would have anticipated.
Mm-hmm. And are there other conditions or causes that sort of look like anaphylaxis or may mimic it that may be mistaken for it? What are some of the other reasons why people could have symptoms that may look like anaphylaxis, especially when somebody's not really trained in identifying it?
Sure. And I think that's one of the most important lessons that we've learned, that in fact, the majority of these immediate reactions, and by that we mean somebody gets the vaccine and something happens shortly thereafterwards, are in fact not allergic or anaphylactic. Many patients have had reactions that include symptoms and signs that might be consistent with an anaphylactic reaction, such as flushing or numbness and tingling, a sensation of throat closure or lip swelling, but without any sort of documented or more objective findings of hives or wheezing or hypotension. So several published studies have now shown that patients with these milder reactions have gone on to receive the second dose of the vaccine uneventfully, which then in retrospect demonstrates that whatever their initial reaction was, it was not an allergic or anaphylactic reaction. Most of those turn out to be something that we're kind of broadly calling immunization stress-related responses, or ISRRs. And some of those are included in the rate of when they're calculating the rate of these reactions. So if you look at the specifics of the reports where they come up, even with the rates of 2 or 5 per million, some of those cases are clearly not anaphylactic, and they're more likely to be these stress-related responses. And I think that by stress, we don't necessarily mean, in fact, we usually don't mean that somebody is particularly high-strung or nervous or before they got their vaccine. But when people get a vaccine, particularly something new and where there's been some discussion about possible side effects, people can have real physical things happen, like flushing, or more subjective things, tingling and globus and whatnot, where something is in fact happening, but it's not because of an allergic reaction to the vaccine. And we really do need to not label those as anaphylaxis. And again, the many, many reports now demonstrating that people who have those kinds of reactions almost always go on to get subsequent doses uneventfully.
Mm-hmm. No, it's really fascinating. You know, early on when we first started learning of these reports of suspected anaphylaxis, as you mentioned, there's no real proteins in these vaccines. So in an effort to identify potential causes, two specific chemicals were pointed out. One was polyethylene glycol and the other was polysorbate. And they were labeled, by allergists and our professional societies and even the CDC as, you know, if you have a known allergy to these, that we want to recommend caution with these vaccines. So in the, 11 months since then, what is the evidence to date shown regarding these early hypotheses surrounding polyethylene glycol and polysorbate?
So polyethylene glycol is one of the ingredients in the mRNA vaccines, and polysorbate in the J&J vaccine and other vaccines coming down the line. Those chemicals are sort of chemically related, but the main focus has been on polyethylene glycol, or PEG. And the jury is definitely still out on whether PEG has anything at all to do with these reactions. The vaccines, the polyethylene glycol has rarely, very rarely, been reported to be a cause of allergic reactions to other medications or products that contain PEG. So laxatives, for example, that you can buy over the counter. Some corticosteroid injections have PEG in them, and so some people who've had reactions to those that do seem allergic or anaphylactic, it's been demonstrated that some subset of those people has IgE antibody to PEG. So even though it's not a protein, it's a large complex molecule that conceivably you could make IgE antibody to. But that's also then the proposed explanation for how somebody could have had a reaction to a vaccine they've never seen before. If they had been previously sensitized to PEG, then they could react to the PEG in the vaccine. The problem with that, the theory was not illogical, but there's several problems with that. One is that we now have quite a bit of data arguing against any sort of IgE to PEG being the cause of the reaction. So the vast majority of patients who have immediate reactions to the first dose of an mRNA vaccine have negative PEG skin test results. And even some of the few who've had positive PEG skin test results have gone on to receive their second dose uneventfully. Some percentage of the general population also has IgG or IgM antibodies to PEG, likely due to these prior exposures. Another theory about how those antibodies might cause something that looks like anaphylaxis is something called complement activation related pseudoallergy, or CARPA. So people are looking into that as a possible explanation as well, but the evidence for that is also still quite limited. Part of that may be driven by the fact that there's really a tiny amount of PEG in a dose of this vaccine, so like 50 micrograms, for example. And that compares when other people have had reactions, say, to a corticosteroid injection that has PEG in it, that has almost 30 milligrams of PEG in it. So even if you're one of the really rare people who's PEG allergic, there just may not be enough PEG in the vaccine to cause a reaction. So folks are still working on that, but we really don't know at this point whether or not PEG is responsible for any of these reactions.
And you touched upon some of the publications, and there's been many great publications throughout trying to investigate, you know, PEG and polysorbate and how best to approach these patients, including extensive skin testing regimens, dose graded administration, you know, things along those lines. So what's the best current advice at this time for allergists and patients regarding polyethylene glycol and polysorbate allergies? How should we approach those patients, or you know, what steps should we take?
Well, I think given the fact that most patients with immediate reactions to the vaccines are not PEG allergic, and that the fact that even patients who are may tolerate the vaccines without reaction, I really don't think there's any place for any sort of PEG or polysorbate testing prior to vaccination, even in patients who have histories that might suggest an allergy to a prior exposure to PEG and one of these other PEG-containing products, because as these various publications have come out, they've become themselves less enthusiastic about PEG testing. The most recent one had a title that included words along the line that PEG testing is of limited clinical utility, and I would certainly agree with that. So there's no story that a patient can tell me about prior reactions to medications or somehow thinking that they're PEG allergic or anything to do with PEG that would make me think that they need PEG or vaccine skin testing prior to getting the vaccine. I tell them just go ahead and get the vaccine, and that the vast majority of them are going to tolerate it uneventfully. Again, because even in those very rare patients who may be PEG allergic, there may not be enough PEG in the vaccine to cause a reaction, and again we're balancing things here, because this pre-vaccine skin testing regimen with the PEG and the polysorbate and all these different doses and whatnot is really an unnecessary barrier to immunization. Now, in somebody who has a convincingly anaphylactic reaction to the vaccine itself, Then I do think some sort of testing is appropriate. And in that case, I think testing with the vaccine itself is the most direct and appropriate kind of testing to do. So if somebody who had something that may have been an anaphylactic reaction to the vaccine, if we skin test them with the vaccine and it's negative, that really argues that their original reaction was not allergic, and they can get their subsequent doses in the usual manner, but typically under observation, given the fact that they had some reaction to the first one. There are reports now, published reports, of patients who've had apparent allergic reactions to a first dose of the vaccine who were skin tested with the vaccine, and the vaccine skin tests were positive, but who have, again, gone on and received subsequent doses, but in graded doses. So this is the time that you might consider offering the vaccine in graded doses under observation, because that also has been successful with this and other vaccines. So even in that test, in that situation, you might think, well, if the patient's history positive for a reaction and their vaccine skin tests are positive, maybe then you should do the PEG skin test and see if that's what was responsible. But again, given the all the variables about PEG skin testing and its apparent very limited sensitivity and specificity, I think any sort of PEG investigation should be confined to a research setting. And that if we really the bottom line would be no testing up front for anybody before getting their vaccine. If somebody happens to have a reaction to their vaccine, again, if it's one of these mild subjective things, they can be reassured that is almost certainly not allergic and almost certainly won't happen again, and they can get their second dose. The ones that we're thinking, well, you know, maybe that really was an anaphylactic reaction, that we would consider skin testing with the vaccine and letting that guide our decision about either a second dose as a single dose or a second dose by a graded dose protocol.
I think that's a wonderful summary. And do we have any information in regards to a non-irritating concentration for skin testing purposes?
We do. So with this vaccine, as with other vaccines, it appears that doing a prick skin test with a vaccine full strength or undiluted is non-irritating, and that using a 1-100 dilution of the vaccine for an intradermal test, diluting it typically in normal saline, is also non-irritating. There was one report that indicated that the Pfizer vaccine could actually be used full strength as an intradermal test, but that's we have limited information on that. So I think the general scheme we follow with other vaccines is sufficient prick full strength, and if that's negative, ID 1 to 100.
Mm-hmm. And most importantly, from what I'm hearing from what you describe, we really shouldn't be saying to any patient, at least due to concern for allergy to these components of the vaccine, that no, you absolutely cannot receive the immunization. It sounds like this is ripe for shared decision making, and we can just figure out the best way to administer it very safely. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And what about all of our patients who have food, environmental, medication, venom allergies? Have we found any signals in regards to increased risk for allergic reactions to any of the COVID vaccines in that population?
Well, it is correct that almost all of the reports about possible allergic reactions to the vaccines in those series of patients, about two-thirds of the patients who report these reactions to the vaccines also report some other allergy, food or drug or stinging insect, for example. And although that could indicate that people with those other allergies are more prone to vaccine reactions, it may be that they're just more likely to interpret symptoms that they may have as being allergic, or to report symptoms that they're having as being allergic because they're allergic patients. And that may be true on the other end, too, the vaccine provider. So because this notion has been out there that these other allergies could increase the rate of reactions to vaccine providers may be sort of more on the lookout for something that might be an allergic reaction in those patients. So the vast majority of patients who have even life-threatening reactions to foods and drugs and stinging insects and all these other substances tolerate their vaccines absolutely uneventfully. So this also does not rise to the level that it would warrant any sort of special consideration or concern as far as vaccine administration. So when I see patients who come in and they have their asthma and allergic rhinitis and food allergy, and you know, but the visit has something to do with their concern about COVID vaccine, I carefully go through all of their other allergic conditions and address those as I would for any other patients. And then I put down my pen and I look them in the eye and I say, now, having said all that, even with your other allergic conditions, you are not at an increased risk to have a reaction to the vaccine. Most people in your circumstance get the vaccine without any reaction. And again, the importance of getting the vaccine far outweighs any potential risk. So I think even though that association is there, again, looking at it the other way, the fact that the overwhelming mm-hmm. number of patients with those conditions will tolerate their vaccines and the possibility of sort of bias in that reporting, I think we can tell patients that they really should not be concerned about their other allergic conditions somehow making them more prone to have a reaction to the COVID vaccines.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's excellent advice. And, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, these conditions, the allergic conditions, impact millions upon millions of people. But on the flip side, as you mentioned, we have this huge, you know, group of people receiving these vaccines, and we're not seeing any scary signals. So we can just reassure all of our patients, regardless of their allergic history, that the benefits outweigh the risk, as you mentioned. Now, shifting gears a little bit, in September of 2021, booster doses were advised for various groups based upon age or other risk factors. What are the current recommendations in regards to booster doses in the COVID vaccines?
So it does appear that immunity after a single dose of the J&J vaccine wanes fairly quickly. And it also appears to wane several months, after even a two-dose series of the mRNA vaccine. So it is recommended that anyone, regardless of age or medical condition or other circumstances, who received a single dose of the J&J vaccine should receive a booster if it's been more than 2 months since their first dose. The booster after a J&J vaccine can either be another dose of the J&J vaccine or one of the mRNA vaccines. Similarly, it's recommended that certain groups of people, even who received a two-dose series of one of the mRNA vaccines, should receive a booster if it's been more than 6 months since their second dose of the mRNA vaccine. And those groups include people at higher risk due to age, greater than 65, underlying medical conditions, or living or working in circumstances where they'd be more likely to have COVID exposure, such as healthcare workers. If you look, though, on the list of conditions that would qualify you for an mRNA booster on the CDC website after you get past the kind of more obvious risk factors, there's quite a lot of conditions under there. And so probably most of the population would qualify for an mRNA booster. And in fact, Pfizer is currently seeking FDA approval to offer the booster or to have it approved as a booster for all adults. I'd have a pretty low bar for anybody to get a booster vaccine.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that I think we've seen is it's as this pandemic has gone on now into almost 2 years of living with this virus and trying to combat it in various ways, just the fatigue has set in. And when the first reports about the booster doses came out, people just started saying, oh my gosh, well, you know, why are we getting vaccinated in the first place? So does the advice to receive a booster dose mean that the vaccines aren't working, or is this sort of an expected occurrence?
The advice about boosters definitely does not mean that the vaccines aren't effective, because they most certainly are. As just one of the examples, as you would expect based on the effectiveness of the vaccine and the risk of remaining unvaccinated, currently virtually all hospitalizations and deaths from COVID now occur in unvaccinated people. As with many vaccines, the protection may wane over time and boosters are required. So, for example, it's recommended that everybody gets a tetanus shot or a Tdap every 10 years. It may also turn out that this, even though we're calling it a booster, is really just the third dose in a series required to produce a more robust or longer lasting immunity, analogous to some other vaccines like hepatitis B. If you get a hepatitis B vaccine, you get a series. You get one at 0, 1 month, and 6 months. And then after that, boosters are not required. That's just sort of the normal series. And that may turn out to be the case with the COVID vaccines as well. So we'll just have to see what happens in terms of immunity over time after the booster doses, in terms of whether or not additional boosters will be required. Even before the broader recommendation for booster doses, you may recall it was recommended that patients who are immune suppressed get a third dose of the vaccine. There was some semantics about that. Well, should we call it a booster or a third dose or whatever? But the idea was, either because of age or some other condition, you may not have mounted an immune response to the first two doses of the vaccine. But it's clear now that a subset of those people will, in fact, mount a response after they get a third dose. So it's even more important for people who have an immune circumstance, including age, that may have made them not have an adequate response to the first two doses, to get a third dose or a booster, because that will, in some people, cause their immune system to sort of finally kick in, if you will, and start making antibodies.
Mm-hmm. You touched upon this earlier about the global distribution of vaccines, and sometimes we don't always have availability of the different types of vaccines everywhere based on location, I should say. So what have we learned about mixing and matching the different vaccines? Is that okay now, especially with the booster doses?
Well, we do in fact have data showing that is safe and effective. And in fact, the current CDC guidelines state that anyone who is receiving a booster dose after whatever their initial vaccine was, anybody who's getting a booster can get any of the currently three available vaccines, either the J&J vaccine or Pfizer or Moderna, the two mRNA vaccines. The two mRNA vaccines are quite similar, and there's likely not any advantage to switching from Pfizer to Moderna or the other way for your booster dose. Given the somewhat lower effectiveness and apparent duration of protection from the J&J vaccine, even though you can get a second J&J as your booster, in that case, some would argue that it would make more sense to have your booster dose be one of the mRNA vaccines.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so basically, it's certainly okay to mix and match, and it I guess based upon your eligibility and what's available in your area, is that how you would advise patients?
Correct, and it at least in here in San Diego, it's really easy to get a booster mm-hmm. of whatever kind you want. I mean, if you go to vaccines.gov and put in your zip code, you'll get a list of all the local places, usually mostly pharmacies, where you can pick the day, the time, the brand of whatever vaccine you want, and answer a few simple questions and be signed up and walk in and get your vaccine. So it's really, but for whatever, you know, individual people, whatever their thoughts are about different vaccines, or of course patients bring their own theories about mixing and matching. And so the importance is to go ahead and complete, to get vaccinated if you haven't, to complete your series if you haven't, and if you're if you're further out from getting your initial vaccine or two vaccines, that now it's time for a booster, and whichever one you're most comfortable with is fine. It would, in most cases, it'll be the one you got before, or as we talked about with the J&J, you might want to follow up with an mRNA vaccine, but the important thing just is that you're getting your booster dose.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's discuss what happens after known infection with SARS-CoV-2. And according to testing data, almost 50 million people in the United States have known to have been infected with SARS-CoV-2 over the last, since the start of the pandemic. So what have we learned about natural immunity after infection? And do these people still need to be vaccinated?
As with the need for boosters with various vaccine, natural infection with diseases produces different levels and durations of protection from reinfection. So, for example, if you've had measles or mumps or rubella in childhood, that appears to confer lifelong protection. So I'm of an age where I'm assumed to have had those diseases as a child, and sure enough, I have antibodies to them to this day, and I never needed to get an MMR shot. So in some cases, having a disease confers lifelong protection from reinfection. However, it turns out you very definitely can get reinfected with SARS-CoV-2. You can have COVID disease more than once. In the case of COVID, vaccination provides greater protection than natural infection. So among patients who have had COVID disease, they're almost 2.5 times as likely to be reinfected if they're unvaccinated than if they're vaccinated. So it's very definitely recommended that even patients who have had proven COVID disease be vaccinated, because that will dramatically reduce the likelihood that they would become reinfected. Also, I run into a lot of patients who describe having had some sort of respiratory illness early on in the pandemic, and they are convinced that they must have had COVID, and so they're protected. It turns out, though, that most of the people who were just sure that they had COVID before testing was available did not have COVID, or if they did, their antibodies have waned from their original illness, and they really do require vaccination. So patients who think, "Oh no, I'm sure I had it, I don't need a vaccine," that just really is not the case. One, because they may very well not have already had it. And even if they did, their immunity has likely waned. And even if we know for sure they had COVID disease, they can get it again, and they can virtually eliminate that risk by getting vaccinated.
Mm. I don't know about your own personal experience, but I was sure that I had COVID maybe 5 or 6 times in the last year and a half. And every single time testing was completely negative. There's a lot of different reasons why people can have similar symptoms and illness that looks like COVID, but is due to something else. Now, for those who have had prior infection, let's assume for the sake of this conversation that they tested positive. Are there any currently available reliable tests or markers that demonstrate if they have long-lasting immunity from this prior infection?
Well, both COVID infection and COVID vaccination lead to an immune response that includes not only the production of antibodies, but also a cell-mediated immune response that's also important for protection from disease. because antibody responses are much easier to measure than cell-mediated immune responses. The antibody tests are what are used to evaluate a response either to infection or to immunization. The available tests look at antibodies directed against two different proteins on the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the spike protein, but also something called nucleocapsid protein. So patients who have had COVID infection will typically have antibodies to both, while patients who have been vaccinated will have antibodies only to the spike protein, because that's the protein that the vaccines are designed to generate an immune response to. If you order a spike protein antibody test, most of the results come back as just positive or negative, although more recently some are more quantitative. They'll give you some sort of a level of antibody or a titer of some kind. And in some subset of those tests, they actually say that they're looking at neutralizing antibodies, which would be antibodies that would not only be expected to be measurable, but would prevent the virus from entering cells. And it's certainly logical to assume that people who have higher antibody levels have greater protection, but that actually has not been demonstrated. We don't know what level of antibody against this protein is really a surrogate for protection against disease. So even in patients who've had COVID infection, who have positive antibody tests demonstrating that they did make some immune response to the infection itself, though we don't know what number to tell them would protect them from reinfection. And again, we absolutely recommend that those patients still be vaccinated.
And not to mention that those numbers, the levels could change over time. So just because somebody has an antibody test today, who knows what that would look like 3 to 6 months from now. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Correct. Okay. Well, just a few weeks ago, COVID vaccines were given emergency authorization for use in children 5 to 11 years of age. What did the data from these trials show regarding safety and efficacy in this younger age group?
Well, first, I think it's important to point out why we're vaccinating children in the first place. Although children clearly are less likely to get severe disease than adults, some definitely still do. There have been hundreds of deaths from COVID in children in the United States. In addition, thousands of children have developed a sequelae of COVID called multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children, or MISC, which may include long-term heart or other damage among the survivors. Also, some vaccinated people can still have asymptomatic infection. An unvaccinated person of any age is much greater likelihood of asymptomatic infection. So it is true that, and that's kind of one of the arguments, again, you hear that, well, gee, now they're telling us that even vaccinated people can be passing the virus around. And while that's true, you're still much less likely to have that asymptomatic infection if you've been vaccinated. Children, if they remain unvaccinated, even if they don't get symptomatic illness, they can very definitely still have asymptomatic infection, which means they're spreading the virus around, including to family members and community members who may themselves then get severe disease. It also allows unvaccinated people who have this asymptomatic infection to be cranking out new variants. So, you know, we have the Delta variant that cause another wave of disease. And the longer the virus has a chance to circulate in people, it has more opportunities to turn into some subsequent variant that may again cause another wave of disease or conceivably could require a change in our vaccine. So just like with adults, it's very important to vaccinate children. But the specifically, it's the Pfizer vaccine that's been approved for use in children 5 to 11 years of age, as you said, as it had been previously, that same vaccine for adolescents 12 to 17 years of age. The adolescent dose is the same as for adults, but for the younger children, it's 1/3 of the dose. As far as safety and efficacy, the rate of adverse reactions was about what was seen in the trials for adolescents and adults, so some fever, headache, fatigue, et cetera, among the vaccine recipients. Importantly, there were no cases of myocarditis in the trials in this younger age group of children. Also, as with adolescents and adults, the vaccine is remarkably effective. It's in this younger age group, the number they came up with was about 90% protection against any form of symptomatic disease in these younger children. So no concerning safety signals and very, very effective in this younger age group.
Is there going to be long-term monitoring of this age group once they, you know, as you mentioned before, sometimes the very rare adverse events may not be picked up until a larger segment of the population receives the vaccine. So will the same type of monitoring occur for younger children as well?
Absolutely. So again, that's a good example where the myocarditis in the older children and young adults was not appreciated in the trials, but was picked up after the vaccine was in wider use because it's a very rare side effect, and that conceivably could be the case. In fact, the FDA paid some special attention to that in their assessment of the vaccine for the younger children. So even though they didn't see any in the trials, and even though they haven't seen any in the early broader use of it in these younger children, there absolutely are active monitoring mechanisms to look for that and other unforeseen side effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned the FDA panel and their discussion that took place. I thought it was very interesting that they spent some time discussing variables to consider in this age group of 5 to 11 year olds, and that the decision to vaccinate may shift somewhat based upon different factors. For instance, in June, prior to the spike in cases caused by the Delta variant, the impact of vaccines in children may have been different compared with now. Can you offer some perspective as to why that is and help us sort of think through this this concept of different variables impacting our decision making?
So the FDA in their discussion, they ran various models or scenarios. So they also, when they're those are the questions they're asking when they decide to approve a vaccine for a different particular age group, is the risk benefit of that. And so they plug various variables into their models or scenarios, and in particular, this risk of myocarditis. And again, they did not see that in the younger children in the trials, and not so far in actual use. But since it was reported and seen rarely in older children and young adults, particularly males, they're really looking out for that. So they sort of plugged that into their models. And part of that then would depend on how much spread of disease there is in the community, because since the Delta variant has a much higher transmissibility, there's going to be many more patients, including children, who get infected with that, and some subset of those children will end up with disease, and some will end up in the ICU, and some of those will have this myocarditis. So when they plugged in all their variables to decide the risk benefit of that, the fact that the Delta variant is out there and is much more transmissible made it crystal clear that the benefits of vaccination clearly outweighed any risk, even the sort of theoretical risk that the myocarditis might occur rarely in these younger children.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about children less than 5 years of age? Do we have any idea when we can see data regarding COVID vaccines in that age group?
Well, the Pfizer vaccine, the studies are very definitely underway in children as young as 6 months. So now we're down to 6 months to 4 years of age. Those mm-hmm. studies are underway, and at least the company anticipates having results here just in the next few months.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Throughout the pandemic, misinformation has negatively impacted medical decision-making and the population-level response to public health measures. Have we learned anything regarding vaccine hesitancy and specifically how healthcare professionals can help patients who may be wary of receiving these vaccines?
Well, misinformation about COVID vaccines has very definitely generated a lot of vaccine hesitancy and resistance. The wide availability of that misinformation online and the tendency of some people to accept the opinion of politicians and celebrities rather than medical professionals has led to a substantial minority who have chosen not to be vaccinated. While controversial, vaccine mandates more recently have led some of those people to go ahead and get vaccinated, but others remain skeptical. And although it's difficult and time-consuming, as we discussed, it's very worth the effort for us as providers to spend time with those holdouts, addressing their concerns as best we can, emphasizing the exceedingly low rate of adverse reactions to the vaccine against the very real risk of becoming seriously ill or dying from COVID, even among otherwise healthy young people, and even among those who believe they've already had the disease and that that somehow protects them. We can emphasize to patients that the development of the vaccines was not rushed. That's one of the concerns you hear quite frequently. The timeline was condensed by overlapping the various phases of development. Phase 1, 2, and 3 trials were overlapping. And they ramped up manufacturing ahead of time so that the vaccine would be available the minute that they could finish the trial. So nothing was skipped. It was condensed, but nothing was skipped in developing the vaccine. So they really were not rushed. We can emphasize that there's no reason to believe that some adverse reaction to these vaccines will appear months or years in the future, because really that's not plausible, and also that's never been seen with any other vaccine. For some, we can appeal to their sense of community, realizing that unvaccinated people can still spread the disease to others and who may become ill or die, and that unvaccinated people may still incubate these other variants. So I think we need to take the time to kind of lay all those things out for patients, and there will be some of these holdouts that will be convinced that it really is the appropriate thing to do.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's great advice for all of us. Well, Dr. Kelso, I have one last question for you, and if it's okay, we're going to dust off the crystal ball, but we're not going to hold you accountable for any of these predictions, because of course we can't predict the future. But where do you see things trending as we head through this winter into next spring of 2022? Do you think we're going to reach a point where this goes from being a pandemic to something that's more endemic and an expected part of our lives? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that is certainly the hope. As our vaccination rates slowly creep higher, we reduce the number of people susceptible to the disease, and the rates of community spread may become low enough that we can gather unmasked and feel comfortable resuming our lives as they were pre-pandemic, as long ago as that seems, which I do believe will likely be the case over the next few months. We'll have to remain vigilant, though, continuing our vaccination efforts, continuing to persuade folks to get vaccinated and to get boosters when they're recommended to maintain whatever control we finally get over the disease.
Yeah, well, and I mean this with the utmost respect, but I really hope we don't have to have you back on next year to talk about COVID anymore. You're welcome back anytime for other reasons, but oh my gosh, this has been a long couple of years. Well, Dr. Kelso, this has been extremely informative, as it was last time we had you on to talk about the COVID vaccines. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to address these common concerns. And before we depart, do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share with our audience?
This disease has claimed the lives of hundreds of thousands of our fellow Americans. And millions of our fellow human beings around the world. We're, as you've indicated, we're all exhausted. But just as with many other diseases, vaccination continues to be our most important tool to control this plague. Smallpox has been eradicated, polio nearly so, measles, mumps, rubella, tetanus, diphtheria. Many other diseases are rare because we vaccinate ourselves and our children. If we're able to convince enough of our fellow citizens to receive these life-saving vaccines, we can also put COVID-19 behind us.
Well said. Thank you so much again for joining us. We hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode. Please visit www.aaaai.org for show notes and any pertinent links from today's conversation. If you like the show, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so you can receive new episodes in the future. Thank you again for listening.